This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain. On Tuesday, just before 9:30 in the evening, an Amtrak train on its way to New York from Philadelphia derailed. Dozens were injured and 8 people died. Later in the program, we're going to talk about safety and technology that might have prevented an accident like this. But first, we're going to examine the city's response. Joining us is Samantha Phillips. She's Director of Emergency Management for the City of Philadelphia, and she's on the telephone with us. Welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Tell me about that moment that you learned that an accident had happened and how it became clear to you that this was a major incident for the city.
I got the first phone call immediately after the first radio communications came through. Emergency management in Philadelphia has a 24/7 watch command function, and they called me immediately. They had heard just lots of radio traffic, initial reports of, what was lots of fire apparatus going to a scene, and then ultimately became a mass casualty incident.
And what was your first, what was the first thing you did? Was it to call the mayor?
So the first thing I did was, I was at home, so started to get myself out to the scene. So the first thing I did was deploy my entire on-call team. So I have field responders and immediately put all of them in service. I also immediately activated the city's emergency operations center and immediately deployed our mobile command post to the field. I then have a protocol where I call various city officials, including the Director of Public Safety, Michael Resnick, Mayor's Chief of Staff and Deputy Mayor for Public Safety, Everett Gillison. And I also did speak with the mayor while I was en route to the scene.
I wonder, most of us would just start to freak out, quite frankly, and there would be a lot of things for someone in your position to do. How do you know what you need to do first?
I think the most important thing is just start to make some notifications to kind of what I would call launch the system. You know, it was unclear what we were dealing with. Initial reports were alarming, but, you know, we do have derailments. They're not uncommon with the amount of rail traffic we have in a, you know, major industrialized city. So it could have been something as minor as just sort of a couple cars leaning. But we weren't sure. And so we wanted to just, our initial actions were to make, you know, the notifications and start to get the right responders, the right leadership to the scene.
So your job is planning for events like this. How well do you think the city did responding to this accident?
Well, initially, you know, it's Friday morning, a couple days out. I would say I think the city did phenomenally. We're going to learn a lot over the next couple of days and weeks. But I would say that I'm pleased with how the city responded as a whole. And I'm incredibly proud of the team at the Office of Emergency Management who worked, just around the clock and, call in. We're a very different organization from police and fire. We are much smaller. We are, we have different functions. And so it's always interesting to see how well we can launch ourselves. And I think we did very well. And we followed our plans and our protocols. However, we adapted where necessary. And I think that's what you need to do when you're faced with an incident like the Amtrak derailment.
And you had a training just the day before the accident. Is that right? Tell me about that.
Yeah, the city is in the process of revising the city's mass casualty plan. And so we spent some time Monday with a group from police, fire, emergency management, health, and other stakeholders testing that newly revised plan. We're actually in the beginning of a series of exercises that we'll do on our planning program. And, I think that's what was so interesting when I got that first call. I think my staff actually has been joking this morning that they thought that that was an extension of the exercise, that I just was, really testing them at 9:30 on a Tuesday night as to whether or not we could really spring into action. We're in a good place because we just did an exercise and we actually have another exercise scheduled for June, and we'll spend time. And that's a great opportunity to look at what happened and make some immediate corrections that we need to make.
Yeah, and it does seem to me that part of a goal of training would be to find you know, holes in your planning. With that training and with the response to this Amtrak derailment, did you find any holes that you need to work on?
I think it's too early to say. I wouldn't say we found holes, but there are definitely things that we need to continue to work on. And it's small stuff, though. I'm really pleased to say that it's small, very nuanced actions, but important nonetheless. And we don't want to lose sight of those. And perfect example is, I think there have been a few instances over the past couple of years that have given us an opportunity to really take stock of our preparedness. And that started actually when Mayor Nutter took office in 2008, really needing to improve and develop and continue to professionalize emergency management. So we've been working at that for the past 8 years. However, the Market Street building collapse revealed a lot of lessons learned about our ability to kind of handle casualties and handle fatalities. And it's not that we don't have the ability, it just wasn't as coordinated as it could have been. So from Market Street, we spent a tremendous amount of time developing a mass fatality plan and working hand in hand with the city's medical examiner office. And, we implemented those protocols very well this past week. We've had incredibly close coordination with the city's chief medical examiner, Dr. Galino. So I don't necessarily think that there are huge holes in our plans, but just small things like, how do we deal with foreign nationals and make sure that we're capturing the right information for the U.S. Department of State, just sort of streamlining manifests of train passengers on what is still somewhat of an open rail system. So just small things that we need to revisit. And I think other things will resurface over the next days and weeks.
That first night, about 1 a.m, the mayor held a little briefing with reporters. I was one of those reporters holding a microphone in front of your face. And you talked about the difficulty of matching up the names of passengers from Amtrak with those at hospitals and getting information to family members. Why is that so difficult?
Well, first of all, I think Amtrak has been wonderful, just a really great partner through all of this. So we got a manifest from Amtrak, which tells most of the story. I would say 90 to 95% of the story of who's on the train. But there are also, Amtrak employees can ride the train and don't need to be ticketed. So we were not sure we were dealing with a 100% list of who was actually on that train. Mm-hmm. And then as we went through the process later in the week, we even discovered that, for example, a monthly rider had handed her monthly pass to her niece. So we had a woman who was transported to a hospital who was never on the train manifest. And we know that that's going to happen. And we're lucky that we even had a manifest. I mean, there's many instances of disasters that happen where it's a completely open community, like a special event, for example, and we have no idea who's there. So we were already in a really good place having a manifest. But with that said, when you have an incident like Tuesday night and you're dealing with triaging and transporting casualties from a scene, they are going by ambulance, they are going by bus in some cases, they're going by police vehicle. And there's just a lot of record keeping and consolidation and reconciliation that has to occur. And that takes time. And so it's lots of different data points, as I've talked about, Amtrak manifest, transport records from EMS and police and fire vehicles, and then also circling back with the hospital intake process. So we've spent time over the past couple of years working through how to do that, and it went smoothly. But, we can always continue to just sort of find opportunities to streamline and consolidate that process.
And is it clear to you now that you have a full accounting of everybody involved here?
Yes. About 36 hours in, we had everybody accounted for, which is really quite impressive. And we've gotten already some initial compliments from the National Transportation and Safety Board just about our ability to give both NTSB and Amtrak a pretty clear picture of what we were dealing with. And that's a testament to our planning, to our preparedness, to our training and exercising, and really to our partnerships. One of the most critical things we did was ask for a representative from our hospital association to deploy to the city's EOC on Tuesday night and work hand in hand with us. And I think that really has helped us be where we are at this moment versus still trying to figure out where people are.
And what is your office doing now in connection with the derailment?
We have demobilized a good number of resources. We still have some support up at the site, light towers and other types of equipment. We're going to continue to support the Amtrak Family Assistance Center, where both family members of the deceased and family members of those who are in hospitals and even some of the passengers have been visiting that site over the past few days and probably will continue to do so. We are spending a lot of time speaking with members of the media, just trying to share what happened. And now we are fully involved in the NTSB investigation. We'll be making sure that NTSB has all of the information that they need regarding the emergency response and survival factors. And so that will be a pretty time-intensive effort. And then looking forward to sort of next week and the next couple of weeks, we will do very thorough after actions of this incident, and we'll partner with Amtrak to do that. But we will also look, you know, solely at the city's response and city's plans. And I'm really looking forward to that. I think that's such an important part of emergency management, learning from these incidents. And anything that we can share with other jurisdictions and our state partners, for example, we want to do that. You know, people should learn from us in this instance.
I noticed that a lot of the communication, or there was communication from your office and from police, asking people to avoid the area that night. Is that really a big problem? People just show up to an accident scene like that? Are they just gawkers or other people?
It's a huge problem. And in fact, at one point, sort of in the thick of things, when we had just a minute to catch our breath, I remember looking at Deputy Mayor Everett Gillison and saying, you know, the incident of the crash is actually a little bit more under control than the parking lot that has been created out on the street. We have a huge problem with that. And, you know, if there are members of the public listening, I know it's well-intentioned. People want to come, they want to see, but they also want to offer help. That's actually pretty problematic, and it detracts from our work. You know, even colleagues of mine from other cities and other states were tempted, and some actually did come to Philadelphia, right, sort of unannounced.
Okay.
And I really appreciate it, but it can kind of interfere with the work we're trying to do.
All right. Samantha Phillips is Director of Emergency Management for the City of Philadelphia. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Next, we're going to turn to safety and discuss technology that might have prevented this accident from happening in the first place. That's coming up on the next segment of Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady. We're going to turn to questions of rail safety in the wake of that Amtrak derailment earlier this week. Also, we're going to talk about the accident and how it might have been prevented. Joining us here in the studio is Joe Martin. He's a civil engineering professor at Drexel University. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And on the telephone, we have Jeffrey Knepel. He's deputy managing editor, deputy general manager of the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, which, of course, we all know and love as SEPTA. Welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
Good morning, Pete.
And Joe Martin, I want to turn to you first, because among the latest news is that we're hearing a lot of talk about how this train sped up just before it was going into that curve, and sort of why that is, and nothing seems very clear. But is that sort of the big question right now?
It's probably the biggest open question, because just to take a second, that the train comes up from 30th Street, goes across at the zoo at the Schuylkill River, and then there's an upgrade to, I guess, maybe 22nd Street. So from there to the curve is about a mile and a half, and none of my colleagues could figure, we thought that it would be getting to that kind of a speed, because that speed was not unusual, and the most unusual thing was the NTSB doesn't waffle at all. When they came out yesterday with 106, you know, that's the number. But nobody could figure out how it got to there.
Hmm. And so how does that question get answered? that's
well,
the investigation, obviously.
Well, among the things that occurred is comes out in the paper. We don't know why. First of all, nobody has a clue why. But the idea is that apparently that the new engines allow that to happen. You know, we don't know why somebody would have done it, but it just doesn't. For example, the Acela probably could. A freight train could never get to that speed at that time. And so Amtrak Northeast Corridor trains are somewhere in between. But just to let you know that probably the L trains could do that. When you come out of a station in the L, the trains have such a huge power-to-weight ratio, it could keep people moving. Bottom line is it wouldn't have been anticipated that somebody would going through from the south at that speed.
And Jeffrey Knepel, let's turn to you. What are some of the big questions that are occurring to you as we learn more about this accident?
Well, obviously, the entire industry is always concerned, especially with a tragedy of this magnitude. Yeah, we want to learn from it. We want to understand what happened. We want to make sure that it's things like this are prevented across the entire country. So, we watch and listen very closely to hear what the NTSB and others are coming out with, and especially Amtrak. Since we run on the corridor, but it's not ours to maintain. So, we do kind of wait for the information to come out.
We've been hearing a lot about positive train control, and sometimes you'll probably during this program hear it shortcut as PTC. That's positive train control technology, and I think I know that's a new term for a lot of us. Maybe you could help explain what is positive train control technology.
Well, and what it's really trying to accomplish is to really reduce the incidence of human error. And that's really the biggest, push for doing this is to prevent deadly accidents. And not only just for the customers on the trains, but even for the roadway workers. In other words, the employees out on the right of way. So basically, positive train control, I mean, we have sophisticated signal systems today, and they are automatic train control, but this takes things a little bit higher level in terms of eliminating human error, and it's to prevent train-to-train collisions, to prevent incursions of trains into areas where workers are, to prevent overspeed derailments, which is probably right now of the most interest, and to prevent a train from running through a switch in the wrong position. So those are the four basic tenets of PTC.
And how does it work? Is it sort of like an automatic pilot on a plane or something like that? What is it?
Basically, what you're doing is introducing a computer onto the train. And now the train knows where it's at. And the train is, the computer is interfacing with the what's going on the train and determining whether it's talking to the signal system, and it's determining whether the train can actually stop in time. And the train now knows exactly where it's at. I mean, that's really the big difference. So it knows the speed that's authorized in a section, and it's looking ahead, and it's determining where a speed change would occur, similar to the situation with this curve on the Amtrak area there. It's determining whether the engineer will be able to brake and get down to the speed that happens when the curve comes up. So if you look at it was actually called cab signals. It's not even as, you always think about railway signals off to the side of the train and lights and all. It's actually now, and has been for some time, even under automatic train control, but there's a cab signals. And so the operator, the engineer is looking over at these signals right off to the side on their unit, and it's giving the train a maximum authorized speed, and it's telling it what its current speed is. And it will make sure that it stays below the maximum authorized speed.
That's Jeffrey Knepel. He's deputy managing editor of, I'm going to say that over and over again, deputy general manager of SEFTA. We also have in the studio Joe Martin, a civil engineering professor at Drexel University. If you have questions and want to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-888- 877-977-9499. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joe Martin, we've heard a lot about how this Amtrak train was traveling more than 100 miles an hour when it went into that curve, and the speed limit there is 50 miles an hour. We're all kind of focused on that, but it also sounds like from comments that you've made, you think people should maybe be thinking beyond that. I mean, we all kind of want to focus on one reason why all this happened, but investigators have to think more broadly than that, right?
Well, the curve has been there for 150 years. And so we start with the alignment of the road. And the road and the railroad is there for 150 years. And during the abandonment of the railroad, so to speak, in the late 50s and so forth, they had this huge wide right-of-way. And at that point, Amtrak picked up the right-of-way. So Amtrak owns the road. As Mr. Nepple said, that SEPTA uses it, but Amtrak owns it. And the road was designed, and there was a huge accident in 1943, and since then there's been perhaps a million trains run through there, so there's nothing wrong with the railroad. That proves the point. But on the other hand, we have a system in the northeast of the trains having to continually speed up and brake and speed up and brake because they were built, the alignment was built in the Model T area. And so much of our problems come, as Mr. Nepple said, to alert the train driver not only to what speed he's at and what it can handle, but what's coming up. And so it would seem to be the logical thing in the future to start taking out those kinks and to try to do it, which is obviously not easy to do in the city. But a lot of the realignments of the shoreline in Connecticut were done in that way, taking out, if you will, ancient and unnecessary curves. So reexamining the alignment basically would to reduce the problem.
And back to you, Jeffrey Knepple, on the positive train control technology, because you've been deeply involved with this issue with SEPTA, and there are some reports that PTC was mostly in place along this section of track, but it hadn't been kind of turned on yet. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm watching our progress on SEPTA, and we still have a good shot at making the deadline. It might be a photo finish, but Amtrak as well is reporting that they are in good position to meet the deadline.
And we should say quickly that deadline you're referring to is a deadline set by Congress in law, that by the end of the year, PTC will be in place.
It is absolutely law, and they are working. But what I think people have to remember is that what we're trying to do is prevent human error, and the system is working to make fail-safe conditions. Well, in that kind of a scenario, you have to do an awful lot of testing of all the equipment that gets put in the field, on the trains, and all of this has to be extensively tested to make sure that it's ready to be in service. So the field equipment generally does arrive and be placed in the field, but then there's extensive testing that has to go on, often at night and off hours, to make sure that the system is operating properly.
And we had a comment from a listener, Anne, who said that she read that the PTC was installed on the southbound side of the Amtrak in this area, but not on the northbound side. Do you know anything about that, either of you?
That speaks to the question of the speed. Is an earlier version was installed. The PTC is not installed, but there's an automatic which doesn't have the final step of being able to control the train, as I understand it. But the key thing is you have to make choices in installation of things. And since it's a straightaway for, I don't know, 20 miles down from Bucks County, it was installed on the southbound side. But on the northbound side, as I said earlier, nobody would have expected it was the necessary thing. You couldn't get to the speed that would be dangerous. So there was a very logical choice in saying we'll put it on the southbound side first and then the northbound, and then a new generation, the PTC, came aboard. So I don't know the details of it, but if I were an Amtrak control engineer, I'd be sitting there and saying they made the right choice. We simply didn't expect that there was a need for it on that rate.
And Robert Sumwalt, with the National Transportation Safety Board, said that if PTC had been in place, this accident would not have happened. He said that very definitively. Oh, yeah. Is that accurate?
That's correct. Yeah.
And Jeffrey Knepel, you agree with that?
I did go to the site, and it does appear to be a speed-related derailment. So, you know, overspeed is one of the basic functions that PTC, you know, is meant to control. So, I mean, if in fact that's absolutely, you know, certainly the NTSB knows more about this than I do, but if that's what they're saying, it is quite possible that that statement is completely accurate.
Hmm. And there are a lot of had really good pictures of this accident, even if we just are watching them on television, because we've got helicopters buzzing around there taking a lot of pictures. And Joe Martin, when you look at those pictures and some of those images of how the train ended up, are there things that seem kind of surprising to you, or and things that would be very important to pay attention to?
Well, when I first saw it, I didn't think of this as, if you don't mind my saying, a conventional derailment where the train slips off and slows down and the flanges drag. It looked from the incredible, not just the accordion phenomenon of the plane, of the train, but trains flipping meant that there had to be a force to flip them over. And then the first passenger car jackknifing, there was just something really unusual, something that had an instantaneous stop of the train. Okay, and that was what I was looking at, the incredible amount of energy. So it wasn't a conventional derailment that would have been possibly due to track defects, okay? Now, as the story went on, then you do the engineering calculations, which we were doing yesterday, then we could see that at about 80 miles per hour, the train starts to become unstable to flip. And then at 100 miles an hour, the train is not only going to flip, but it might push out the rail and knock the spikes out. So our original expectation that a train wasn't the issue, which was quite reasonable, just led to a puzzlement that something incredibly stopped that train just hitting a wall. Now, the fact that it went from the front to the back meant that the front went off first because the last couple of cars are sitting there and people are actually walked off of them. So there's a lot of things from simple physics that you can derive from this.
Good lesson. And when something like this happens, at the beginning, you just don't know what you don't know, as yes. Donald Rumsfeld might say. But we received an email from Paul who asked, does the black box data recorder, everybody calls it the black box, I don't know if it's black or not, on
it's
a
orange.
Train. It's orange on a train, okay. But he asked if that data recorder provides any information on the engineer's actions, like applying the throttle or the brakes or any sort of information like that would be helpful. Do either of you know the answer to that question?
I believe that it does provide information on the actions of the engineer with the throttle and things like that, yes.
And we also received an email from Avi who asked, please explain, what does the engineer have to do in order to increase speed? Is it possible for the engineer to increase speed, you know, even if they like fall asleep or lose consciousness or something like that? Is how does that happen? Do either of you know the answer to that? I mean, we don't have an Amtrak engineer here. But
no, I don't know those details. But the dead man's thing was invented 100 years ago. But to stop a train, if an engineer loses his grip on the throttle, the train automatically slows down. And this is 100 years old.
Yeah, let's go back to the topic of positive train control technology, because we are hearing a lot about this, Jeffrey Knepel, and that was mandated by Congress after a 2008 accident in Southern California that killed 25 people. We already talked about that deadline at the end of this year to install positive train control. SEPTA is one of the few agencies around the country that looks like you're set up to meet that.
We have worked very hard, and we haven't let a moment go by. It's been a very difficult time for us because before 2013, the end of 2013, when the Pennsylvania legislature made a dramatic increase in our capital funding, which has just changed things for us enormously, this was a low point in our capital funding back in 2008 and 9 and 10. But we sacrificed all, you know, other needs and made sure that we could move forward with PTC. It's a massive amount of work because it's affecting our signal systems, our vehicles, our control center, and communication systems. We will spend $328 million by the time we're done, and we've spent about $240 million now.
Wow. And there are some people who are asking Congress to extend the deadline to 2020. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, SEPTA had a good set of circumstances. We were following the Amtrak model because they do have positive train control on the northern end of their system up near Boston. So they already had a system that was considered compliant, and we did follow that model. The engineering department is right in Philadelphia. We were very fortunate. PTC is a lot of it is radio-based, and we were able to get the radio frequencies, or they call it spectrum, very early on and at a reasonable price, but some other agencies have had all kinds of trouble obtaining the radio frequencies they needed to advance the project. So I think, you know, it's tough to characterize all railroads the same. Some properties have to deal with a lot of freight traffic as another further complication. In many cases, some people are tenants, like we are on Amtrak, as opposed to the landlord, so to speak, and your rights are less. So there's an awful lot of issues to deal with in making a system meet the deadline. And so some agencies are, and certainly the freight carriers that have an enormous infrastructure, are having difficulty.
I think positive train control technology, something we're going to be hearing more about. We're talking about the Amtrak derailment this hour on Radio Times, and we've had here in the studio Joe Martin, civil engineering professor at Drexel University. Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And on the telephone, Jeffrey Knippel, the deputy general manager of SEPTA. There, I got
it
right. Woohoo! We're going to get this down yet. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today.
All right.
Coming up in the next segment, we're going to switch to the politics of Amtrak. If you have a question, you can give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Back in a second after a break. This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the Amtrak derailment in Philadelphia earlier this week, and we're going to spend the last segment of this hour talking about politics. Joining us is Colby Itkowitz, a national reporter for the Washington Post In the Loop blog, which has the amusing tagline, "Afflicting Official Washington Since 1993. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I'll just talk to our listeners for just a second here. If you have a question about politics, we can take your telephone call. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. The email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, and our Twitter address is @WHYYRadioTimes. And I want to start with just kind of step back from what's happening right at this moment, and maybe we could talk a little bit about Amtrak because, I mean, I live here in Philadelphia, so I know that it can get me to New York or to D.C. It's transporting people around the country, so it hauls people, not freight. But, you know, those big freight railroads, they're clearly private companies, and Amtrak is sort of a private company, but it also gets subsidies from the U.S. government. What is Amtrak?
Right. So Amtrak, since the early 1970s, is a for-profit company that is subsidized by the government. The revenue that Amtrak brings in only makes up about 3/4 of its operating costs. So the federal government comes in and covers that last about $1 billion. What that means is there's not a lot of money left over for things, for any kind of capital improvements, any kind of upgrades to the system, to the equipment, which is why they have some cars that date back, you know, to the early 1900s, and the equipment's really old, and there's just not enough money to improve it.
And there are some people out there who don't think Amtrak should even exist as it does, mostly Republicans, as I gather. Is that about right?
Yeah. I mean, Amtrak has long been a punching bag on Capitol Hill. George Bush had it zeroed out in his budget each year. Republicans are always trying to underfund it or take cut funding for it. A lot of them believe that it shouldn't be the government's job to subsidize a rail company. And yet, when you look all over the world, that's the case in Europe and in Asia. The government is propping up passenger rail. It's a priority in those countries, and they have state-of-the-art, the sleek, high-speed rail that is kind of the envy of rail enthusiasts in America.
And but Amtrak does have its advocates even on Capitol Hill.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously Joe Biden being one of the most famous Amtrak advocates, but mostly, you know, you see Democrats on the Northeast Corridor who take the train home from Washington each week. They're the ones that fight really hard for increasing funding for Amtrak. They say that, you know, you could, with real investment in Amtrak, if you could put true high-speed rail on that, especially in the Northeast Corridor, you would cut travel times, you could really boost revenue, you would cut traffic on I-95. You know, if you could get people from Washington to New York in 90 minutes, imagine the possibilities. But that takes a lot of money and a lot of will, and it's the type of will that Congress just doesn't have right now when it comes to investing in our infrastructure.
Yeah. The day after the crash, there was a vote in the House of Representatives. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So the president had requested doubling Amtrak's budget. They give them about a little like $1.5 billion right now. He had suggested popping that up to about $2.4 billion so that there would be money for capital projects, for capital improvements. What the House Republicans did instead was cut the $1.5 billion that they get down to about $1.1 billion. Because they have these budget caps in place, and Republicans are saying, listen, we've got to keep within these mandated budget caps, and we have no choice but to cut Amtrak funding. So what that means is Amtrak will have, you know, if that goes through, about 18% less federal funding next year.
There's someone on the telephone who wants to jump into this conversation. We have Gaylord from Bucks County. Gaylord, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yes.
Hi, thanks for calling in.
There was a statement by John Boehner saying that the notion that there's a link between the government funding and the accident, that notion is stupid. But I'm, you know, just looking at a body count, I think, you know, if you compare Amtrak to ISIS, for example, Amtrak has killed more people than more Americans than ISIS has. I think the money should go there as opposed to, say, wars overseas, that we should pay more attention on focusing on making sure that Americans here at home are safe on our public railways.
Okay, I'm not sure about the comparison to ISIS, but that idea of spending more money to make sure that Amtrak is good and safe, that's something that's out there, right?
Colby? Oh, yeah, absolutely. And your caller is correct that John Boehner kind of snapped at a reporter yesterday who asked about inadequate funding for Amtrak and said, you know, this is a stupid question. You're just following this line of attack that the Democrats started, you know, as soon after the accident. But what is true is there's this technology called positive train control that in 2008 Congress mandated that all passenger rail cars put this in, and what it would detect if a train was going over its speeds and would put on the brakes. Amtrak was supposed to have that installed by the end of this year, and they are far behind. And what they will tell you is that it's because of a lack of funding. Now, Republicans come back and say, you know, there's all this other bureaucracy in place, there's something with the FCC and something they had to approve and they didn't get it done in time. But at the end of the day, Amtrak just doesn't have the funding to do these kinds of upgrades that are necessary to bring its system into a state of good repair, much less modernize it.
Yeah, and Amtrak's finances, I think, are an interesting topic because, as you already pointed out, the country funds it to about $1.4, $1.5 billion a year right now. And when you look around the world at how other countries fund their systems, that's not a huge amount of money, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look around the world also, I think one thing is a lot of Republicans and a lot of people that say that we should be out of the passenger rail business say, you know, our rail's not turning a profit. Well, passenger rail doesn't turn a profit in anywhere in the world. And it has to be a desire. As a country, you have to decide that you want to have a passenger rail system that is efficient and modern and realize that it's a good and a service that you're providing to the public and not look at it as a moneymaker. And the problem in our country is that they want to make money on Amtrak, and it's just an unrealistic unrealistic expectation.
And one of the comparisons that I saw was you got the $1.5 billion the U.S. spends on Amtrak here. I saw a New Republic article that pointed out that Britain spends $8 billion a year on passenger rail. So that sort of puts some of that into perspective. And I think that some Democrats were arguing that looking at this accident, that makes it clear that you need more funding, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think we have to also realize, though, that the makeup of our country is very different than the makeup of England or Germany. Their cities are much closer together. It makes more sense to transport people by rail, whereas, you know, we built our country in the 1950s on highways, and the Americans have a love of the automobile. A couple of years ago, I was actually in Germany working on a story about high-speed rail, and this woman said to me, you know, in America, little kids get toy cars. In Germany, little kids get toy trains. Huh. And that's just the difference between where our priorities are. We've invested all this money in an interstate highway system and never put money in a national rail system.
And here in the Northeast, we're focused on the section of Amtrak that a lot of us use, and it gets a lot of use. But there's Amtrak around the country, and some of that would never turn a profit, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing with the Northeast Corridor is the Northeast Corridor props up the rest of the system around the country. It is the only profitable line that Amtrak runs. And think about how many cities you have close together running up and down the Northeast Corridor between D.C. to Baltimore to Philly to, you know, Newark and Trenton and New York up to Boston. It makes sense to have a rail system. But, you know, out in the West where things are much more sprawled, it's harder to convince people that to ride the rails there.
We're talking with Colby Itkowitz. She's a national reporter for the Washington Post In the Loop blog. If you want to join the conversation, you have to do it pretty quickly, 1-888-477-9499. You had a piece yesterday reporting that there's a $200 million limit on what Amtrak would have to pay in this accident. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, sure. So back in the late 90s, when Amtrak was pretty much bankrupt and Congress was in the process of bailing them out, they added a little-known provision that would put a liability cap on how much Amtrak has to pay per accident to all defendants for all claims, which means that no matter what happens from this accident, all of the victims and all of their families will have to share a pot of about $200 million, which spread out among all the people that were on that train is probably going to be less than what they would normally get for pain and suffering, medical costs, you know, lost wages, all the things that go into damages. Was something that was a major issue in 2008 when there was a commuter rail that crashed with a freight train in Los Angeles, killing 25 people and injuring more than 100 others, and they had to share a pot of about $200 million when the judge out in L.A. said if they had gone to court individually, a lot of them would have been able to get $300, $400 million just on their own. Hmm. And they were walking away with just a little over $1 million.
So Congress put that in place. That cap, is there a sense that that's going to be part of the discussions going forward?
So I've asked around about that. After the accident in 2008, California Senators Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer had offered a bill to increase the liability cap to $500 million, and that went nowhere. I have the sense that when we start debating passenger rail reauthorization, this will come up again. The rail companies say this would absolutely bankrupt them because the amount of insurance that they would have to take out if it was a higher liability cap or no liability cap at all, they wouldn't be able to afford the insurance costs. So that if that debate does come, I think Amtrak and passenger rail and commuter rail are all held to the same standard, and they're a little worried about that. But on the other side, Democrats will say, you know, and others will say, if you get badly injured and you aren't able to work anymore, or you lose a loved one, or what is that worth? How do you put a price on that?
And is there a sense that that legislation will be moving forward now? Because it was kind of a little stuck there for a while.
Yeah, well, it often is. Like, as I mentioned, there was an Amtrak bill that passed, an Amtrak reauthorization bill that passed in 2008, shortly after that Metrolink accident that I referenced. That bill expired in 2013 and has not yet been reauthorized. Now, the House did pass a bill in March reauthorizing Amtrak, not adding any additional funding, but kind of changing the structure. One of the things it would do is allow the Northeast Corridor to take its revenues and invest it back in itself, as opposed to having to subsidize the rest of the system, which is great for the Northeast Corridor, but essentially kind of kills long-distance rail around the country because there's no way they can prop themselves up. The Senate has not written a bill yet. Cory Booker said this week that he had actually intended on introducing a bill to reauthorize Amtrak on Wednesday, but in light of the accident, they're going back to the drawing board and seeing what else needs to be done.
We did receive a call from George. We're not going to be able to take the call because we're up at the end of the hour here, but George wanted to make a point that you've been talking about Amtrak's profitability, and other people talk about its profitability or unprofitability, but he asked, what's the profitability of the average highway or the average street? And they seem to get maintained regardless of the profit.
Right, and so it's interesting. The highways are very different than rail in that they have a dedicated trust fund that pays for them. So you as a user pay a tax on your gasoline. That goes into a pot, and that pot then pays for highways. So for a long time, highways were paying for themselves in that way. Now, because of people not driving as much and more fuel-efficient cars, that hasn't kept pace with spending, and we've had to borrow money from the general treasury to prop up highways. So what has used to be an argument that highways could pay for themselves isn't true anymore. But your caller is right that we do make sure to keep highways funded.
Hmm. What are you going to be looking for next? You're watching folks on Capitol Hill. What's the next thing you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really interested to see what the Senate puts down in their Amtrak reauthorization bill and how urgent or quickly they work on this. Often what we see with Congress is they are a reactionary bunch, and when there's a tragedy or a crisis, that's when they kind of spring into action. So I'm interested to see if the Senate will come together, pass a bill, and how they will be able to conference that with the House, and if it's something that will be more robust than what the House had passed.
And are you getting a sense, just kind of talking to members on Capitol Hill and their staffs, that there's any sort of momentum building there?
Certainly on the Democratic side. I think the Democrats are seeing this as, for lack of a better term, an opportunity to really make the case for more Amtrak funding and a more investment in Amtrak. Republicans are pushing back hard on that, saying that it's politicizing this tragedy and that you shouldn't be tying a funding fight to what happened on Tuesday night. So we're going to see that play out over the next, you know, weeks and months.
We are talking with Colby Itkowitz. She is the national reporter for the Washington Post In the Loop blog, and she has a bit of a Pennsylvania connection, too. You were the D.C. correspondent for the Morning Call for a while.
I was for many years, yep, and I'm born and raised in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, so lots of ties to PA.
Yeah, well, it's very good to have you on the program today. Thank you for helping us sort of sort through some of the politics here related to this Amtrak derailment in Philadelphia.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I'm Jeff Brady, and I've been filling in for Marty Moskowane today, talking about this derailment, and a lot more is going to be happening in coming days, but that's it for the end of this hour, I'm afraid. We are going to end the hour with a bit of a tribute to B.B. King. He died yesterday at his home in Las Vegas. We're going to listen now to the Blue Boys tune from his 1998 album, Blues on the Bayou.